Hello everyone, welcome back to the Japan Archives episode 79. Sorry we missed last week. We had a bit of illness, feeling under the weather, but we're back again now. And last episode, I know I said last week, but last episode I mentioned I wanted to do something more historical again. So this is kind of historical in that we're going back to the emperors, but obviously these very early emperors, a lot of legends surrounding them. We're not sure if they were in fact real or if they were made up or if they were based off something that got changed over history. And I've been doing a lot more research since we initially did the bonus episode on the successors to Emperor Jimmu, and we ended up the episode on the 10th emperor, Emperor Sujin. So I want to do him again today. I want to give him his own episode, go over him a bit more in depth. I think it is good if we revisit old topics once we know more. I don't know about you, Heather.
Yeah, I think we've mentioned that quite a few times. I think we've run into a lot of things. We'll come back to this someday.
So that is what I will be doing today. But as usual, how are you doing, Heather?
I'm still giggling about we're going to come back to these things in our giant list that always grows. Good. Actually, I'm channeling my toddler right now, just kind of how she says it. So, but yeah. Doing all right. How about yourself?
Pretty good. I'm very motivated to do this. So yeah, I'm all good. Very productive right now, as usual. So without much further ado, I guess let's jump into it. Emperor Sujin, the 10th emperor of Japan. Oh, my chair be squeaking. Sorry about that. So this Emperor Sujin is what we know him as now, but of course they had other names, personal names, private names, and things like that. So he was also known as Mima Kiiri Biko. I'm going to say this slowly. It's a very unique name. let me try that again. Let me just drink some tea.
I'm drinking some water. So
I will say it more slowly. His name was Mima Kiiri Bikoi Nie, or another extra name we could call him was Mimaki Irihiko Isachi. And this emperor, well, I say we know, but he has been given the date of ruling from 97 to 30 BC. So we're still not AD yet. We're almost there. And as for this emperor's characteristics, I've used, again, several references for this emperor. These early emperors are normally cataloged in old Japanese documents when they were trying to compile the first histories of Japan. So I've used the Kojiki, the Nihongi, as well as another book that I've been reading lately called the Jino Shotoki, which also covers the early emperors as well as much more of Japanese history, actually. So the Nihongi states that this emperor was intelligent, fond of manly devices in youth, and as a man, he was circumspect in his behavior and a man of wide culture. So he definitely enjoyed education and learning. As for his family, this emperor, he was the son of the previous emperor, Emperor Kaika, and his mother was Ikagashi Kome. As for his family was large-ish. A lot of these early emperors took a wife as their empress, but they also had several concubines. So his empress was called Mimaki Hime, and together they had six children, one of them being the future emperor, Emperor Suinin, and the others were Izanomawaka, Kunikata Hime, Chijisuku Yamamoto Hime, Yamato Hiko, and Iga Hime. Now, here's testing your memory, Heather, here.
No, don't do that.
Yamato Hiko. Do you remember Yamato Hiko?
No.
No. So we mentioned Yamato Hiko. So we're slowly connecting our episodes together. We mentioned Yamato Hiko many moons ago when we covered human sacrifice.
No way.
Yes. He was the... Well, I will elaborate now. So Yamato Hiko was the one that his retainers were apparently buried with him alive. And following after this, the man known as Nosukune approached the government and said, this is an ancient practice that maybe we should change. And then they made the dolls and said the haniwa. So that was our connection to Yamato Hiko. So he was the son of this emperor, Emperor Sujin. And he also had, like I said, two other concubines. And with those, he also had an additional six children. So he has 12 children overall, this emperor. So like we said, this emperor ascended the throne in 97 BC. And he was originally made heir to the throne when he was 19 years old at the time. The main events of this guy's reign was that it's recorded that there was a giant plague in Japan. It covered the whole country, and apparently, at least from some sources, it said that over half the people of Japan died. The emperor then feels he's doing something wrong and requests punishment from the gods. But also at the same time, like, he's requesting punishment from the gods, and Amaterasu, the sun goddess, as well as Okuni Nushi, who was the, I guess, main heavenly deity that lived on Earth prior to the first emperor's coming, they were worshipped together in the imperial palaces. And Sujin also says at this time he became fearful of their power, so that is when the gods start to be given their own separate shrines and temples throughout Japan. So he's requesting punishment from all of these gods, and so he communes with them through divination to try and figure out the source of the plague, what he can do or what others could do to try and resolve this. And as usual, we have different accounts depending on whether we read the Kojiki or the Nihongi for these stories. Mostly the story is the same with a few little changes here and there, but like the main element always remains the same. So both of them, in summary, basically say that Okuni Nushi comes and talks to the emperor, saying that he knows how to stop the plague. But in another version, he also says, oh, I started the plague. And he says that, I need you to find this guy called Otataneko. He's shaking your head at the name.
I was just thinking, like tall cat for some reason.
That guy's name, the beginning bit, Otata, is used of the kanji of big, rice field.
Okay.
And Neko, I'm not sure what the first kanji is, but the last kanji is the kanji for child.
Okay.
So no, he's not a tall cat. That would be interesting.
That would be fascinating. I was a little disappointed, but okay.
So Okuni Nushi has said, I need you to find this guy, Otata Neko, and I want you to make him the head priest of my shrine up on Mount Mimoro. Mount Mimoro being in Nara Prefecture. He's also instructed to find another guy called Igakashiko, and if this guy makes offerings and worships the deities of the earth, it would also help in abating the plague. So of course Sujin seeks this guy out. He's trying to find him in Japan. The Kojiki and the Nihongi differ in the villages that this guy was eventually found in, but he is found and he is brought over to palace. When he gets to the palace, they do ask, oh, who are you? Who are you descended from? Why is this god specifically asking for you? The Nihongi states that he is the son of Okuni Nushi. So I suppose in a way he is half god. The Kojiki does differ, saying that he is a descendant of Okuni Nushi in the fourth generation. So he would be the great-great-grandchild of Okuni Nushi. And to explain how this marriage happened between Okuni Nushi and either his mother or his great-great-grandmother, it says that this woman, who is known as Ikutama Yori Bime, she woke up one day and she was just pregnant. She was just pregnant. So her parents come up to her and they say, did you do this by yourself? Did you make yourself pregnant? Like, why are you pregnant? And she turns around to them and says, it wasn't me. I did not do this to myself. Someone came in the middle of the night, and now I am pregnant. And so her father and her mother, they give her advice and they divine a way to figure out who the father could possibly be. She is instructed to sprinkle red earth in front of her couch or her bed, and to pass a skein of hemp through a needle, and to pierce the needle through the skirt of a garment that she is wearing. I suppose this might have been some ancient form of magic, because in the morning when she wakes up again, the needle now points towards the way the kami, or the god, had entered and left her home. And he had left through a small opening in their house, and they follow the needle out of their house, and it keeps pointing to where, I guess, the guy who impregnated her was. And eventually it leads her all the way to Mount Mimoro and Okuninushi there. So that is how they found out her child was the child of Okuninushi. And the reason that he came to her is because he decided that he would come to her and make her pregnant in the middle of the night while she was sleeping, because she was very beautiful.
Oh, okay.
It sounds almost Zeus-like in story. He just found a pretty woman and was like, she can have my child. Very Zeus-like.
Very horrifying.
Yeah, just a little bit. Mr. Tall Cat has been found. And he is placed as the head of the shrine for Okuninushi. And that actually does help to end the plague. So the plague has finally been finished. I don't really see why the god had to make a plague to get his descendant as head priest of his shrine. He could have just contacted the emperor, I suppose. That would have been a lot easier. Could have threatened him with plague. Not make the plague first, but I am not a god. What do I know? So,
yeah.
So after this, some references I found said that what I'm about to talk about happened because the emperor feared these items would be polluted by the plague that was happening. Others simply said that he just wanted to make new copies. So this does, again, we're going back to another earlier episode about the sacred regalia.
Oh.
So during his reign, he decided that he wanted to have created a new sword and a new mirror. What he wanted to do was he wanted to keep the replicas with him in his hall for divine protection, but the others he wanted to entrust into one of his daughters called Toyosuki Iribime, and she took the sword and the mirror to their new home at the sacred enclosure in Kasanui in Yamato Prefecture. So again, we're still in Nara Prefecture at the time. And later on in this princess's life, she was then contacted by the sun goddess. And she gets contacted by the sun goddess, who then tells her that she should journey throughout the provinces with the sword and the mirror, I suppose to show the people these grand special items. Who do you think made these replicas, Heather?
So many challenges for me tonight. Oh no.
I've asked you like 2 questions.
I know, it's such a challenge. I'm gonna go with Otataneko.
Okay, I see your reasoning. To make a new mirror, he literally summons the original goddess who made the mirror. He calls down Ishikori Dome from heaven and says, can you go to the village of Uda in Yamato and fashion me another mirror? And she goes, okay. As for the sword, he gets a... So if you remember, the sword was never made by the god. It was found in the dragon, Yamata no Orochi. So to make a new sword, he can't call upon the person who made it, because we don't know who made it. So he calls down a descendant, again, of a god. It doesn't say who the name of this descendant is, but it does give the name of the god. So he calls upon a descendant of the god Ame no Mahitotsu. And this is the god of smithing in the Shinto religion. So it makes sense that he would choose a descendant of him. And his name is actually interesting. His name can translate as the one eye of heaven. So it's thought that maybe he was blind in one eye, but it also does link back to old blacksmithing where they kind of relied upon one eye or the dangers of smithing as well. So I think it's a really cool name there. I think it's interesting that they don't really explain how or the why, but early emperors still seem able to commune through divination with gods, but also that the gods are happy to come and be given instruction and orders by emperors.
That's true. That's true, because the emperor's commanding the gods to do things. Or, well, asking, I don't know if commanding specifically, but
Probably asked very nicely for fear of them being gods.
that's probably wise.
After this, the emperor decides to honor various kami around Japan, and he orders the guy we mentioned before, Ikagashi Koo, to make offerings of black shields and black spears, as well as red shields and red spears to the different kami surrounding Japan. In addition to that, offerings of cloth were made to the hills and the river gods. And actually, this was the final thing required to eradicate the plague for good. It's all gone now. The plague is finally over. You would hope after this he has it easy for the rest of his reign. However, there is a war coming. To start off, Emperor Sujin had four generals. They're in the old text, they're called the Shido Shogun. And these four people were Ohobiko, Takenuma Kahawake, Hikoimasu, and Kibitsu Hiko. All of these different family members, uncles or ancestors or sons, things like that. And they are sent out to subdue the provinces. They want to make Japan unify. They want to stop all the rebels. Ohobiko, he heads out on his way. So they all head out to separate areas of Japan. So Ohobiko is his uncle. He's off on his way and he just comes across a girl singing a song on a hill in nothing but a loincloth. And the song goes as follows. I'm not sure as to the meter of this, so I'm just gonna say it. I'm not gonna try and sing this. So it goes, "Now then, O Prince Mimakiiri," which again is another name for Emperor Sujin. So now then, O Prince Mimakiiri, ignorant that they to steal and slay one's life cross backwards and forwards by the back door. Cross backwards and forwards by the front door and spy. O Prince Mimakiiri. Ohobiko then thinking this somewhat strange to find this girl up on a hill singing, inquires her to her, saying, "What do you mean by this?" And in response, she says, "It's nothing but a song," and just vanishes before his eyes. And so he decides that he's going to return to the emperor to tell of this tale. For fear of it being something important, especially as well after the song does mention the emperor's name. The emperor, listening to this tale, believes that the person in the story who sounds like he's going to betray him relates to his half brother. And depending on some sources, they do say it's his uncle's brother. So he fears that his half brother is going to come and attack him. So he asks Ohobiko to raise an army and go and stop him. So when he sets off, he takes a man known as Hikokuni Buku with him. He's not related to the imperial family. He just seems to be of a man of high ranking from this time period. So they head off together to Yamashiro province. And when they arrive at the Wakara River, they find that Takehani Yasu is actually already waiting for them there. So he was definitely planning on attacking. Interesting thing I found out culturally doing this research was the story says Hikokunibuki was begging the other side to shoot their arrow first. Do you know anything about the culture of war or arrows in Japan?
I haven't encountered that yet.
So it's said that when a fight was to break out, it was custom for each side to let an arrow initially fly. And the arrow was considered especially important and was often shot off reverently before battle with prayers to the gods or the kami. So he was begging him to shoot the first arrow, and Takehaniyasu eventually shoots first, but he misses. And so Hikokunibuku returns fire and kills Takehaniyasu in one go with
Ooh.
one arrow across the river, which causes his army to rout and flee. His half-brother's army is then hunted down and killed, with the two men then returning to give their tale of victory to the emperor. Now, that story is how it goes in the Kojiki. The Nihongi does, however, change the story slightly. It says that when Ohobiko returned to the emperor to try and figure out the meaning behind it, it wasn't the emperor who understood the message. It was his aunt, Yamato to Hime. And she understood the song meant that, again, Takehaneyasu meant to attack them. And she gives further evidence to this, saying that she saw his wife, Atabime, taking soil from upon Mount Kagu. Mount Kagu being an important symbol to the imperial family. It said that when she took up this soil, she placed it in her neckerchief and turned it upside down, saying that this is the land of Yamato, thus symbolizing she wanted to turn the land upside down and put it into turmoil. In this version of events, Takehaneyasu and his wife Atahime arrive with their armies, coming from two different directions to attack. Kibitsuhiko intercepts Atahime, defeating and killing her and all her men, whereas again, Ohobiko and Hikokuniwuku kill Takehaneyasu with their first arrow. After this, his aunt, Yamato to Hime, killed herself with some chopsticks.
What?
Yeah, there we go. Let me elaborate on that for you there. So after the battle, bearing in mind Okuninushi has already claimed ancestry to Mr. Tall Cat, he marries the emperor's aunt, Yamato to Hime. He never showed himself during the daytime, which kind of makes sense linking back to the other story where he only came in the night. But Yamato to Hime really wanted to see what he looked like, so she said, please stay. I want to see what you look like. So he said he would stay one morning for her, but he would hide in her toilet case. So upon the morning, she gets up and she opens her small little case, I guess, that she takes to the bathroom, and inside it she finds a tiny small snake. And not expecting a tiny small snake, she is a bit scared and startled. The snake obviously was the god Okuninushi, and being ashamed that he caused her to be fearful, or ashamed of her for being fearful, he decides to leave her. So I guess, I don't know how long they'd been married at this point, but he decides to leave her and return to Mount Mimoro. And it is said that Yamato to Hime, saddened that he had left her, kills herself with some chopsticks by stabbing herself in her genitals. It seems like a weird addition to the tale. Wasn't needed. And like, yes, it was just a small paragraph added in, like, oh, by the way, they got married and then she killed herself because she was, you know, embarrassed to God. Like, okay.
This story has got so many different
twists and turns. It goes everywhere. It's not just a happy rain, is it? You know, you got slaves sent by gods because they want their son to worship them. Then you got a war, you know, the only way you found out is because a half-naked woman is singing about it on a hill. And then, to top it off, your aunt kills herself with some chopsticks, because... But we're not finished yet. But
oh, goodness.
I'm going to say it's less weird now, okay? I think, from what I remember. These two momentous things, I guess, have happened. They have passed, they are rectified, and they are over with. So now Emperor Sujin needs to decide upon an heir, and he decides to do this in the 48th year of his reign, according to the Nihongi. And so he orders two of his sons, Toyo Kiiri Biko, who was a child through one of his concubines, as well as the future Emperor Suinin, who at the time was called Ikume. So he orders them to have a divine dream. I'm not sure how you can have one of these, but he just asks them very nicely, please go and have a divine dream for me and let me know what you dream about. Now, both of them do dream about being at the top of Mount Mimoro. So again, we're having that link back to Okuninushi. Toyoki Iribiko, standing upon the mountain, sees himself flourishing a spear 8 times and swinging a sword 8 times, all while facing towards the east. Whereas Ikume says that, again, he stood atop the mountain, but he placed a cord all around the four corners of the land to drive away the sparrows eating at the country's grain. And so the emperor decides that Ikume will rule over the land as the future emperor, as his dreams seem to be him looking after all of the land, whereas Toyo Kiiri Biko would rule over the eastern part of Japan, as that seemed to be his main focus in the dream. And that is how the successor was finally chosen. After this, I wasn't sure at first when I was reading this if this was the sacred regalia again, like the mirrors, the swords, and the beads, but it appears to just be something that was called a sacred treasure in the text, but not the sacred regalia of the imperial family. So in the 60th year of the reign, the emperor wished to see some sacred treasures that had been brought down to earth again by a different god, a different kami called Takehira Tori. And at the time, these were being stored in the big Izumo shrine, which you can still visit today. Someone is sent to go and retrieve them. The emperor doesn't go to see them himself. He wants someone to go and bring them back for him. So at this time, there was a man known as Izumo Furune, who was in charge of looking after these sacred treasures. But when the guy arrived to, I guess, borrow these items to take them to the emperor, he was away on holiday in Tsukushi, which was the old name for Kyushu at the time. And so Furune's younger brother, Ichi Irene, says that, okay, you can take them. And so he entrusts them to his brother and his son. So he entrusts them to his brother, Umashi Karahisa, as well as his son, Ukatsu Kunu, to take them to the emperor. He doesn't actually give them to the guy who came on the emperor's command. He gives them to someone in his family, I guess someone he can trust. Furune finally returns from Kyushu, angry that his brother gave away these items, even though it was at a request for the emperor. But hiding his anger, he invites him out to go and visit the Yamiya pools to go for a swim, as well as visit some of the plants there which were in bloom. There, Furune then kills his brother in anger for giving these items to the emperor of Japan. And so the other brother, Umashi Karahisa, makes report of this to the imperial court. And so the emperor dispatches Kibitsu Hiko and another one of his generals to go and have Furune killed for killing his brother in anger.
So we did get less weird, but we got a lot more drama in this
part. Yeah, it got very dramatic.
I feel like I should have written down the names as you've been talking. Yeah, There's so many names.
Luckily, this is research I've already done, so all of the information is up on page for Emperor Sujin on the website. If you cannot wait for the show notes to come out on Wednesday, feel free to hop on to historyofjapan.co.uk and search for the Emperor Sujin page. It's all there for you. So now we're coming towards the end of his reign. With the plague over, I mean, it was a while back at this point, but it's only just now the emperor decides to create the first ever census of Japan, as well as beginning the first taxes. For men, he taxed them on animal skins and game, and on women, he taxed them for textiles that they made. It said that the emperor said that the country should have a fleet of ships. He also started to build pools of water in areas that were dry and scarce of water to improve upon irrigation. And at this point, one of the old kingdoms of Korea at this time, called Myanmar, makes tribute to the emperor. And so with all of that done in his reign, a very busy reign, I feel, it said that the emperor died at the age of, take a guess, Heather, here, we're on the big side for these legendary emperors.
Ah, that's right, aren't we? I'm going to say, what if he's about 278?
You overshot a bit there, but I like your gusto there. So the Nihongi and the Jino Shotoki says that he died at the ripe old age of 120.
Oh, so young.
Whereas the Kojiki makes him a little bit older and dying at the age of 168.
That seems more reasonable.
That sounds more reasonable for an emperor. Mm-hmm. But that is my tale. That is my story of Emperor Sujin. There definitely was a bit more information than the last time. Definitely worthy of an episode in his own, I feel. I mean, what do you think? I feel that a lot of the times when we do historical episodes, there's a lot of names. So many names.
Very, very many names.
Super old history. The names are ridiculously long.
Different sounds than we're used to hearing put together.
Exactly. Yeah. What did you think?
I mean, there was so much drama going on, but I feel like we got more about what was going on around Sujin rather than so much about him.
Yeah, because the battle, it was everything that happened away from him. There was no, he did this during the war. It was like, okay, go do my battles. Everything that happened during that away from him.
With all of the dramas and the wars and the fighting and the, yeah, I mean, definitely very quest and dramatic and very, Taiga drama is what I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
I could see this as being one of those.
Yeah, I do like it.
I mean,
I feel that most of the time now when we do historical episodes, we are always connecting to previous episodes or, stuff we've talked about before, which is nice to have those callbacks and also expand upon stuff.
Yeah, definitely our threads are becoming more entangled.
So what do you got for me this week? What's over there in Heather's Corner?
Oh, so with the transition to Heather's Corner, I decided we need to transition again for the name. I remember this now. We were talking about this and then we didn't do last week. There's I've mentioned this before, characters called Sumiko Gorashi. And Sumiko, do you remember what Sumiko means?
Sumiko, they're like unwanted items, right?
Mm-hmm. But Sumiko, the actual word. Do you remember? But yeah, that is what the definition of the Sumiko Gorashi is.
I don't remember.
It's corner. So we're going to do I'll say this and then I'll find it later. Oh, that's not how you're supposed to do it. But Sumiko no Heather is what we're going to now call Heather's Corner.
I like that.
So we get a slight Japanese definition, but again, I could be wrong because that has happened embarrassingly more times than I can count, but that's all right. So this week on the Sumiko, I think it's my first culture note.
Oh, okay.
I think I'm going to call it a culture note. I might be wrong. You can tell me after I say it, you can tell me if it's getting late and my brain's just shutting down, but this came up this past week. I've got a couple of friends who do language study as well, and they encountered this in a book and asked me, and I went, oh, this is true. It's not something I've thought about. I'm going to ask you because it depends. You may know this. You may not know this. I'm not going to say I feel like you do because then I say that and then you're like, no, that's challenging. But it's a possibility that you might have encountered this before, especially as you've driven in Japan. Now, the stoplights in the UK, what colors are they?
Red, amber, and green.
What about in Japan? What color are they?
Red, yellow, and blue.
Why?
Because old Japanese, they often used aol as a word for green, which is why Aomori Prefecture is called the Blue Forest. When it actually should mean green forest. Did I win? Did I get points?
You got lots and lots of points. So many points. I'm so excited. Yeah, the stoplights are called owl. And you're right that back in, do you remember when? This is like an extra challenge bonus point.
When did this start?
No, when did it switch to have more of a division between owl being blue and midori? Departing away from owl, because before it was owl was basically any cool shade like blue or green, those colors were all considered ao. But around what time did they depart? And then we start having the word like midori pop in.
1854. I have no idea.
I was going to say, I don't think.
1854, it was a Tuesday, and I think it was about 6 p.m. when they decided.
I like the way we're specific. I'm just going to say Heian period as okay. when that started coming
up. Heian period. Let me check my quick poster, because every time I read like Heian period, Nara period, I have to check my the date. So Heian period, 794 to 1185. Earlier than I thought.
Yeah, and definitely after Sujin.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, in Japan, they're called ao. Thomas, when you see the lights, I mean, it's been a while since you've driven, but, you know, you do still walk and you still see the lights. What color does it look to you?
Oh, interesting question.
Because they're called blue lights. They're called ao. But what do you think it looks like?
I mean, they're green. However.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I once did see an actual blue light. I forget where. I think it was in the middle of nowhere in the countryside, in the north somewhere. But it was blue. And then it reminded me that blue and green are almost the same in Japan at times. It was so bizarre to see it.
You know, I've never seen that. I've only seen the... I think now I was reading a couple of articles, and this is the first time I had seen that there was actually it's considered I think it's the bluest shade of green you can get. And the reason why is I think a lot of countries have adopted the red, yellow, or you call it amber and green light as the standard for driving lights, but Japan never adopted that standard, but they kind of followed along, but also sort of not by getting the bluest shade of green they could. So they still had a green, but it was blue, but also green, but blue. But the newer lights, the LED lights, they look really green to me.
Yeah, they look much greener.
But I do have, I'll probably link it in the show notes. There's a couple of articles I pulled up. One has the picture of the blue light like you're talking about, which I've never seen. I've only seen the green ones. And it is definitely because the turn signal is green, but that light, there's definitely differentiations in shades. Man, that was a hard word to get out. But yeah, that's why if you ever played the game Red Light, Green Light in elementary school, or I don't know if it's called something different in the UK, but I tried to do that in my classes here and they're like, green, what are you talking about? Green light. I was like, oh, well, you know, a signal that's blue. Oh, no, it's green. No, it's blue.
What do we call that at school? It's gonna irritate me now.
So what now?
We played this guy. I've played this game many times when I was at school.
It's called something different.
But well, we never said red light, green light.
Oh my goodness, there was an episode of Chico-chan about this. I just remember now that I think you don't
call back to Chico-chan.
I know. I love that. It's great. There's so many topics, cultural, historical things that I've come across there. Do you say anything? Because in America, we say like red light, green light, but I think you just turn.
Yeah, right? We just turn. You don't say anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I forget what
but
it's called.
But the game does have a name.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to irritate me now until I remember. Thank you.
But you got my question. Beautiful answer. So just soothe you. Let it soothe you.
It's not something I've actually thought about for a while. I always remember it if someone mentions Aomori and I'm like, Blue Forest. Oh, yeah, the reason why is this. But... like, I don't really think about it when I see the traffic lights because, like you said, it's the bluest shade of green they could get. So in my brain, it's still green. So I don't actively think, oh, no, that is blue to Japanese people.
You know, it's not something I really think about either, but friends mentioned it and I went, oh, this is really cool because it does also tie into history and the etymology of the language changing from, you know, one period from the next and the differentiation of colors that wasn't. So it does tie back into history. Are you looking up the game now?
It does. Hang on. It's really irritating me.
You're looking at
so
me.
I had oh, check.
Great topic, Heather. Yes, yes. I'm sorry. Let me just go over here.
You just completely no. I'm sorry. You are correct though.
I want to know the name too.
Interesting, but
what's the name?
We just call it standing statues.
Oh, that makes sense. I mean, that makes sense.
Or just statues.
Okay, yeah. Good. Well, at least now we know the answer to that too, because I was going to...
Now we know that. Now we know. Sorry. I'm so sorry. But yeah, you said, it's interesting that I didn't expect it to be that old. Like you said, to me, it felt like something very new, like the separation at least. Because I was thinking, oh, it's probably something because when they opened up to the West, they probably started changing to like adopt our ways or make things easier for them to understand and us to understand. So obviously... outside of Japan, there was a big differentiation between blue and green. So that's why I thought it was so modern. But I wonder what, now I need to know the why as to the separation in the past. So I await your next blue-green Sumiko Kona to elaborate on this for me.
I would try to find some other colors and just make a rainbow out of it.
Heather's rainbow.
Oh my gosh. Just keeps evolving like a Pokemon.
It does. But thank you everyone for tuning in this week. I hope my section was interesting. There was a lot of names and a lot of weird turns. I definitely enjoyed your corner today, Heather. So thank you for that cultural reminder. I do appreciate that. But that is everything from me. How about you, Heather?
I do believe that's all. I think.
All right, everyone. Until next week. Matane.
Minasan, kiosukete. Matane.